Thank you very much, Graham. You've laid out a lot of the broad picture here and a lot of issues that we could delve into, and I'm going to leave it to the audience to choose which directions we go into. I do need your help, however. Please, before you ask a question, if you could identify yourself and the organization with which you're affiliated. And also, if you're not at the table, it's helpful if you go to the mic in the center back there to ask your questions. If you are at the table, please feel free to speak normally. I saw this gentleman here first. Here? Yeah? Yes, you there?
I'm Ken Bateman, International. I have two comments.
Go to the mic, please. At the,
you just have the mic.
Okay, that's fine.
I have two comments. The first is extremely thorough, good presentation, great quality. Second is there's a bill currently before Congress that was introduced by Congressman Dauber of Massachusetts and Houghton of New York, called the UN Rapid Deployment Act of 2001. It's H.R. 938, and it calls for the establishment of a standing a police and security force that I think would actually address many of the problems you highlighted here. It would be uniformly trained, uniformly equipped. It would be comprised of volunteers from around the world that really have to be vetted by some standards set up by the UN, and it would be deployed only with a Security Council resolution, so there would, it wouldn't be willy-nilly shooting around the world involving itself in rushed by a force. And this is something that has not received, a huge amount of support from either the Clinton-Bush administrations, but it would resolve a lot of these problems. The force could be deployed only for 6 months at a time, so it would give the world community a chance to formulate a new solution, whether it's a police force or a military force to go in. It could be bigger, it could be smaller, but it would be a stopgap measure that would allow a skilled force to get them right. I don't know whether you're familiar with that, but it might be something you can take from that.
Okay, here in the corner.
Dr. Grant, speaks to the Law Education Fund. I was curious that you didn't spend time talking about the problem of recruitment and understaffing of the system. I was wondering if you could comment on that as a kind of a key problem with the whole fiscal apparatus or ability to make a difference.
Yeah, it's a many-layered problem. One could produce all sorts of statistics to say that there is no shortage of international police and qualify it by saying that there's a distinct shortage of suitable international police. When the United Nations asks contributing countries to produce either soldiers or police officers, by and large, there's always someone willing to produce something. Whether it's suitable to the job you have in mind is entirely different. If we accept that there is a nominal standard for international police officers, then yes, frequently contributing countries cannot produce enough of sufficiently qualified officers. And that goes back to the way police officers are employed in society. Every country has as many police officers as it wishes to have. Typical North American ratio would be 250 population to one police officer. In Europe, it might be 350 or even 450 in certain countries. But they've got a notion of how many police officers they need to do their national law and order job, and they don't have reserve battalions of police officers. So when you have a call for several hundred to come from a relatively small national police force, you are depriving communities of their nationally of their police officers. One of the ways around this is, in fact, for concerned international development agencies nationally to fund extra positions in the national police force or in local police forces such that there is deliberate excess built into the system. I quote this because it's the case in Canada that the Canadian International Development Agency, CEDA, funds, I believe, 50 RCMP positions and then has turned around to the RCMP and said, do never say that you don't have 50 policemen who can go tomorrow to a police mission, because we are giving you the money for 50 positions. And I think that kind of creative use of development funds has got to be looked at. there are other short-term, quick-fix solutions. I certainly view the notion of the rapid deployment police force as a quick fix. It's good for relief situations, but it's not good for development. For development, you've got to stay the course, and that might mean lending specific expertise to a specific country for years. And that is also something that a lot of national police forces have difficulty with. The notion that the UN, where it will probably never be given authority for a standing army, might get the authority for a standing police force, which would be extremely useful, is a very good notion and one that I would encourage people to support. I mean, it's an idea whose time is overdue.
In the corner over here. No, you should be fine. If
six miles of my name, I'm retired. You started a case which is East Timor, where I got to work. And I hope you don't mind my saying this, which in many ways actually jumped with the model that you and complied with the model that you set up. But there's another model, which was the Kosovo model, where there was a level of mistrust between the population and the existing police force, which was known. And so what you posit about cooperation with local law, with local police, was simply impossible. The result was, as you probably know, it was K4 that was running Kosovo and anything back to it. And I wondered, in your model, how you deal with this sort of thing as a way of solving this particular problem.
Well, Kosovo is, of course, one of the problem children of the moment, and there is no flip answer to this. First problem with Kosovo, you have to know what is the end state you're driving to. And Landon, could you bring up the spectrum of possibilities? Okay. Once you've decided whether you're driving Kosovo towards full independence, full reintegration, or some form of autonomy, once that big strategic political decision has been made, you know which style of capacity building to do. Landon, if you could go to the capacity building slide now. The point is that you don't build completely independent structures if the region is going to be reintegrated back into the sovereign territory. You don't have to build on the former national structures if it's going to be fully independent. So the key issue for Kosovo is the end political state. Now, there are all sorts of good reasons why that has not been settled yet. And until you have settled that, you will, by definition, be aimless or directionless in the way you're trying to build local capacity. Now, within Kosovo, what else can be done? In Kosovo at the moment, you probably are suffering from a situation of a gradual diminution in the consent of either a small or significant part of the population of Kosovo. The sense being that they had expectations or anticipation of full independence, and they sense that they may be not achieving that or being cheated in some way of that. And so the nub of that particular problem is extraordinarily difficult for anybody to deal with. That is the bit that is extremely difficult. The issue of 90% of police work, you know, the routine jobs, the domestic infractions, the parking tickets, the stuff, the daily business, the bread and butter of life. Kosovars can be trained very quickly to do that. That is not difficult to do. What is difficult to do is to settle a political issue by non-political means. And the strategic thing has to be settled first. Where's it going? What's its end state? How do we build the capacity to achieve that? We know what to do once we've decided on the end result.
I've got a number of you on the list. I'll work my way through it. Kurt Masuner, U.S. Institute of Peace.
I just wanted to clarify, Graham. I've read your paper even though I came late. And one of the questions I have in terms of reaction to having, I don't see how you get around the conundrum of cultural sensitivity, at least at the very outset of a mission. Right then is what you're talking, if you have ready capacity to react. You need a short, sharp shock to get put the lid on and then build on that. Do you see that as primarily still a military role, the way it was done in Somalia, and UNICEF actually did relatively well and didn't follow up on it. That's what we failed in Somalia. It wasn't just to manage to scare the hell out of months.
Okay. Inevitably, this is once again a many-layered question. Inevitably, in any international intervention, particularly military intervention, there will be a brief window of opportunity immediately following the arrival of the international force. Local actors, by and large, will be somewhat in awe initially of the international force. Classic case of this, I think, hindsight now, 2020, if IFOR had acted in a resolute way in the first 30 to 60 days after it had arrived in Bosnia, we would have been years further down the pipe of law and order than we are today. So that's one thing that is very clear. I think military forces have got to be in their pre-deployment training, understanding that as the ink is drying on the ceasefire agreement, if they're the only people on the ground, they are responsible for law and order. They cannot duck that obligation. Now, if that means that they pack a couple of extra MP battalions to go with them, so that when the fighting is stopped, they deploy their MPs very quickly to prevent looting and whatever, so be it. That's an interesting issue that I think a number of countries will be addressing. If it means that they take with them a gendarme MSU-type force who actually deploy after the ceasefire, that's another issue. But militaries have got to stop planning that they only do the military job. They must plan that they will do this bridging initial, set the scene for the law and order issue. Cultural sensitization. This is where the notion of the group of friends is really important. I was impressed in my experience in Central America with the role played by the group of friends for the peace process, particularly in El Salvador, surrounding countries and donor countries who got together as groups of friends. The friends can provide key elements in the initial contingents. If you're a surrounding country, you probably are sensitive to the history, the culture, quite possibly the language. It was tremendous in East Timor whenever a Malaysian or Singaporean police officer was sent to our contingent. They were friends. They were sympathetic to the situation in Timor. They had understood the culture and history. They were not directly transferable, but they were, if you like, cousins. And many of them, of course, Bahasa Indonesia, Bahasa Malay, are very, very similar languages, so they could speak with the local people. You have got to put an element of that into your initial deployment. You have got to seek amongst the friends someone who's going to put up a large, not necessarily dominant, but a large sort of sector. So you can get over the cultural and you can get over the institutional shock of that first deployment.
Let's go to the back row there, please. Yes, sir.
Mike Jagic from National Defense University. Graham, another scintillating presentation. Laden with insights on the culture of the international civilian police and the local police culture. But I'd like to take you to that third category, the broader societal culture that and the conflict that's always going to be there between those standards of human rights and the standards of democratic policing and the norms that prevail in that society and in that culture. Because you have a situation where you have at least two or three groups that have been in conflict. And if Kosovo is a case I know most about, but there's permission on the part of that culture for a policeman or for anyone in society in Albania to kill a Serb, they don't get due process. So I'd like to ask you about how do we deal with that cultural difficulty and assert that even if we had a perfectly attuned international civilian police and we were very sensitive to all the local taboos and trained the local police to do a very good job, when we leave capacity building, all we would have done is train them to be better at repressing the minority. And so how do you build something into that situation so that when we do depart, we get democratic policing?
Yeah, that question is a little bit like the message from Robin Hood where the arrow goes, thanks, Mike. Yeah, I'm sure you do. Obviously, this is, if we could do this properly, we could do it all. So, I mean, that's the magnitude of the question put. You have to nibble at this sort of issue. You have to take an incremental first approximation, second approximation, third approximation kind of methodology. There is no home run. Okay, so in this respect, Kosovo is not much different to Timor or anywhere else. There will always be raw, powerfully raw edges in society where revenge and not justice is the motivating key, the motivating factor. Let me describe a process that we used in Timor, and this will give you a sense of how you can start doing your approximations. In Timor, about more than 100,000 people ran away or were taken away by the militias as the militias left, as Interfet arrived. And the problem for these people returning is the problem that you've just described, Mike. They had varying degrees of culpability in the terrible situation that had preceded and immediately followed the popular consultation. And so, you go to what the village knows, what the village understands, and in lots and lots of village meetings, I kind of boiled down a very simple rough and ready methodology in my mind. First group that are your consideration to return are people with clean hands. Somehow they were just caught up in the tide of history, but their neighbors know them to have clean hands. These people could return, they would be embraced by their neighbors, there would never be a problem with them, and so they simply were just a logistical thing for UNHCR to organize trucks to get them back if they could get free of the clutches of the militia. Such people did return, and we've seen situations in the Balkans where neighbors have returned and have been embraced by their former neighbors, you know, brought coffee, rakia, whatsoever. It happens. It's, let us say, it can approach a majority. 50%+ can be truly innocent. However, you then get to the next group of people. These are people with dirty hands. What does dirty hands mean? Dirty hands means they stole something, they burnt something, they were part of the propaganda apparatus. They're implicated more strongly. Now, by and large, communities know who has done this, and it's in the community that you must get the solution. And I would suggest that there's a number of models of alternate dispute resolution that will do this. And we certainly in Timor, in my region, settled on having an interview with people with dirty hands that had expressed an interest to return and say, if you're prepared to admit at a village meeting what you did and ask forgiveness and accept the decree of the village meeting, then we can work with you and get you home. Those who did say that, and we even had militia members who said, yes, I'm prepared to do that, would come, would stand up in front of their village or community, they would admit what they had done, they would ask, they would say that they were genuinely sorry, they would show remorse, they would ask for forgiveness, and they would say, I accept whatever you guys are going to suggest we have to do. Then, traditionally, they have always had a series of, mediated by village and clan chiefs, village meetings where certain forfeits were paid for various antisocial activities. We grafted into that the notion that our human rights people should be in there monitoring, that the CIVPOL should be monitoring the situation, and that the judicial affairs officer would always have the right to say, that someone is being railroaded here, we're going to take this to a more official venue. And we also encouraged them to think in terms of, if someone admits to having damaged community property, then they must do some kind of community service to repay that. In other words, an attempt to get to justice, an attempt to have the community involved, an attempt to get it victim-oriented and not just process-oriented. And by and large, within crude parameters, the dirty hands people could be handled within that process. You now get to the third and final category, a very small category, but a very dangerous category, people with bloody hands. And if you had bloody hands, the culture in Timor was such that the family, the clan, was required to take revenge. There was no option about this. If you were known to have been part of the group who killed the boy, or whatsoever, then the only advice we could give those people was, don't return. We don't have enough police or soldiers to protect you. Now, that was the first approximation. That was the first iteration of that process. You can see how it would get more complicated. in fact, the people with bloody hands should appear in front of a formal judge with formal hearings and have a formal sentence if it is proven that they really do have bloody hands. And I think that is the only way finally out for that. But first approximation, you go to the village level, what the village sort of common sense, the average guy in the street will take as reasonable. And you've got to work from there. But there is no home run. And it's all culturally oriented. Further aside, in Mozambique, child soldiers being reintroduced back to their villages where often they killed a family or clan member had to go through a very specific cleansing ceremony in order to be able to be accepted back into their village. But if they went through the ritual, the cleansing ceremony, they could be accepted back. So this is really the nub of what you're getting at, Mike. But thanks for asking.
Sonia Bezerko, senior fellow at the Institute of Peace. Please come up to the microphone, yes. Thank you.
I wonder how you overcome obstructions when you first deploy the police forces in a region like Kosovo, language-wise, and because these are very close communities and they are very reluctant to witness or to be helped, to give hand, let's say, in prosecuting the killers of opposite side. So I've been to Kosovo and Pristina in the court when a young policeman came to the judge asking for the rules and the law, the local law, and he was communicating through a young girl interpreter. So, and I saw how big obstruction it was because it took 1 hour to explain what happened, and in the meantime, the street, what happened in the street was already over. So I wonder how you really proceed and how you prepare people before they go to the field.
The issue of language is enormous. Once again, I come back to my comments about the group of friends. If there's any way that you can get non-involved contributors who speak a similar language, you've got an enormous advantage. In my region in East Timor, we had a Jordanian peacekeeping battalion who were suspect from the beginning by the local people because they were Muslim and the army that had been repressing them was Muslim. And, of course, they came from a totally alien culture. These are essentially desert village boys being thrown into a jungle village environment. So they had tremendous troubles until we managed to get 30 non-commissioned officers from the Malaysian forces, one per platoon or even section, and all of a sudden we started having tremendous acceptance in the local population once the Jordanians could find a conduit to be able to talk to the local people. So the language thing is absolutely fundamental and vital, and once again it comes down to mission planning. Planners have got to factor in huge resources in the language side. There is no point in deploying 1,600 police officers and 4 interpreters. It just is a waste of time. Of course you're going to get inefficient use of CIVPOL. And you have got to get interpreters from wherever you can. Diasporas are both good and bad at providing interpreters, but you've got to look there. You have to be very careful of the incredible political bias that can grow in a diaspora community. However, where you can find a part of the diaspora that can be recruited to help you as interpreters. No mission should move without its mission anthropologist. I come back to this thing. I mean, and that there should be anthropology advice available to missions down to the field level. Because interpretation, as you know, is not just language, it's culture. I mean, it's critically important to understand that. There are certain areas of the world where, and Kosovo is a very tragic example of this, the Albanian language is not a very widely spread language. It's a very small language. And so one is really hampered by to find people who can speak Albanian and translate and interpret for one. But there's no simple patch solution, Sonia. It's a real problem, and it's got to be thought of in the planning process.
Right here,
yeah. Alan Weinstein, Department of State. Graham, I just wanted to follow on a little bit from Mike's earlier question, which is, so just to what degree does one sacrifice justice with a little j for justice with a big J, namely, as a matter of institution building, of building real police capacity, and so on. to what degree must one ignore, by example, the Genesee Bears, their past actions and so on, as a matter of inclusion to move forward in the building of institutions and the developing of reconciliation? And how in a model like your own, would you propose reconciling not returning populations, but in the building of a police force that may or indeed must include those with bloody hands, by your categories?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Firstly, the notion of sacrificing justice at all is very difficult, and the reason for that is that truly without justice there will be no reconciliation. Without reconciliation there is no enduring peace. I mean, it's trite, but it's true. Now, the sequencing and prioritization can help you. In the model where I talk about establishing central institutions, a key central institution is the office of an ombudsperson or the establishment of a Truth and Reconciliation Committee. If, in a post-conflict situation, sufficiently heinous crimes have been committed that an international tribunal is appropriate to try crimes against humanity, that is obviously the highest level of justice that you can achieve. At the next level down, many communities need the support and catharsis of a Truth and Reconciliation Committee and the Office of an Ombudsperson and Human Rights and things like that. What is very important is that they are in the model from the beginning and they're set up at the beginning. Bosnia has waited now, I think it's 4.5 years post-Dayton for a Truth and Reconciliation Committee. Frankly disgraceful. Frankly disgraceful. Many things could have been done in Bosnia if that had been one of the first things established along with the Hague Tribunal, where and a working methodology whereby the Hague Tribunal admits, look, we're only going to get the big fish. Plenty of other fish are out there. This must be told. Communities are seething with anger, with resentment. They need to have their story told. They need to be formally recognized. It needs to be stated. Even if we don't bring them all to the dock, a degree of reconciliation is achieved like that. Not perfect, but a degree. So, timeliness, a suite of methodologies, and the most important thing, factored in from the beginning. Not nice to have add-ons as we get a little more money, or as newspapers make life sufficiently difficult that we feel we have to do it. We should address these issues front and center from the beginning, and in this sort of suite of answers fashion.
The back there, yeah.
I'm Heather Hurlburt from the International Crisis Group, and I wondered whether you'd thought about the implications of your methodology for places where the international community has a profound interest in exactly this kind of police capacity building, but there will never be an international police presence of the kind you're describing. I think of Indonesia proper, where I think everyone agrees there's a huge need for increased police capacity, but how on earth to go about it, or Congo or Sierra Leone, where you're in a post-crisis situation, you're unlikely to ever have the kind of big mission you've had to work with in Timor, and what of this can be useful and how in those circumstances?
There is a long tradition of bilateral relationships where democratic countries with an interest in a region or a country have offered support in various regions of law and order. Now, if we look at the U.S. experience with this, there was a time when it became politically impossible to, in the post-Latin America, post-Central America liberation movement period, when it was shown that former training had just made the police even worse at what they were doing, and being human rights abusers. But the methodology of bilateralism is a valid methodology. It's just a question of the correct political orientation and will to do that. In a large sovereign country like Indonesia, if they don't invite you to come and give them assistance to various aspects of their agencies of law and order, I see no other way of affecting them. And in that respect, the technical mission, the UNDP type technical mission, the bilateral assistance, is a a proven method, if not a particularly exciting method. That's to deal with that end. I would suggest, in fact, that many of the examples in Africa where the problem is a failure of central institutions in general, in that there is a state in name but not much of a state in terms of its structure and its institutions, that in fact these are classically the cases where the full transitional administration can be reasonably and usefully employed. Also with a transitional administration, you can decrease sector by sector the amount of intervention that you do, depending on how local capacity builds and is able to take over. That's the best that I can do for you.
Bob Orr with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Graham, first, thank you for an excellent presentation. I was wondering where you come out on the tension between, when you're creating a new police force, the tension between having a fresh start, clean recruits that haven't been part of the conflict, and the other imperative of trying to demobilize soldiers on both sides and the natural instinct to want to put some of the previous combatants into the police force. I know you were in El Salvador where this kind of a very strange mix of 60-20-20 percentage of 60% of clean forces and 20 from each side roughly worked. And there are other examples where it hasn't worked as well. Where do you come out on balancing the clean versus the capable and the need for demobilization?
That's another real tough one. What I think is an element in El Salvador that has to be considered, the Salvador case study, was the breaking up of the old command and control arrangements and the breaking up of certain units. And to a certain extent, just breaking those units down and redistributing those personnel meant that some of the death squads were effectively put out of business because they did rely on little mafia-type circles of silence. By and large, the full demobilization and then the reconstituting of the force has got to be the model, the preferred model. However, in the post-conflict situation, it is completely acceptable, I think, to have a larger than optimal police force. I am not advocating that the police force should be used as a welfare agency, as an employer of last resort, but there is something to be said for cushioning the impact of going straight to the optimum size police force and leaving disgruntled, unemployed people on the street. And so I think that clever use of the public sector to soak up employment in the post-conflict situation can include the police, it can include the army. The rush to demobilize is not always the right thing. I think that we had this at the demobilization workshop that we were just at in Nairobi, some of us here. The holding of election doesn't mean democracy. The demobilization of an army doesn't mean that you have got peace. And so you've got to take a measured approach. The one home run attitude that we get one cut at this and that's the way it's going to be is not always your friend. An iterative approach, a gradual scale down can help you. But I think it's very critical where, as in the case of Salvador, where you have proven police complicity in absolutely, you know, crimes against humanity, death squads and that sort of thing. Firstly, individuals have got to be held accountable. We must not back off from that principle. And secondly, units must not be allowed to stay formed. You can recycle, revet a lot of those officers, but you must not allow the old command and control relationships, which will often have elements of coercion and blackmail in them, to remain. Otherwise, you're just putting a rotten apple back in the barrel. So demobilize fully, perhaps reflate a slightly inflated police force, cushion the impact, and do a second cut after the economy starts going.
Graham, we actually have a question from the web coming in from Galina Schneider at Work the Peace, and it has to do with the issues of the recent developments in Macedonia. and the problems along the border. And her question has to do in particular about whether you think there might be a role for CIVPOL, an expansion of CIVPOL opportunities, for instance, in UNMIC, to perhaps help with spillover monitoring and other kinds of preventive measures that might prevent paramilitary groups from making excursions across the border, or is that entirely a military responsibility in your mind?
This question talks to a really difficult issue, that of counterinsurgency, and what is the appropriate societal response to counterinsurgency, because of course one person's terrorist is another person's freedom fighter, and that will really color local community perceptions as to how people should be dealt with. Freedom fighters are heroes, and they should be rewarded, they should be applauded for their actions. Terrorists should be locked up and the key thrown away. So the policy implications are profound. First rule of thumb is that you cannot expect effective enforcement from people who have inferior means of coercion. By this I mean have smaller weapons. So if you are against, if you have a counterinsurgency problem with very heavily armed groups, the group that police or provide a constabulary force in that area must meet and or beat the weapon capability of the people they're against. Having said that, the notion, the police notion of appropriate force is the guiding principle that has got to be applied in these areas. Too often, the idea of punitive force has been used in counterinsurgency type operations, and all that has done is feed the cycle of violence. It's a completely nugatory exercise. So you have to have credible coercive measures available to you. You have to have you have to have credible coercive measures, and you have to be culturally appropriate. Now, what that means in the Macedonian situation, on the Kosovo side of the border, there is clearly both a military component and a community component. The community component should be addressed with issues like community policing. It is a long-term prospect, but it's necessary. However, you cannot expect community policing to address strictly border issue, border patrol type issues. That has got to be a military commitment. So once again, you need a suite of responses. There is sometimes a case for this third force, the constabulary force of gendarmerie, more heavily armed police. But I think in the Kosovo case, it's more a case of strong military presence, international military presence on the border, and then really working the communities at the community police level, and understanding that counterinsurgency takes decades. It doesn't take months to work.
We have time for one more question right here. Could you identify yourself, please?
No. Okay. Let us be absolutely clear. The Karadzic and Mladic have been guarded by groups of bodyguards with moderate to heavy weapons available to them. Absolutely. And the only credible force in Bosnia, in and around the Balkans, to do that is the International Military Force. And the fact that the International Military Force have deliberately sidestepped and evaded that issue does not bring a great deal of honor to them. It is. Quite simply, in Bosnia, we have not gripped the organs of law and order well enough that the Serb police will go and arrest a Serb war criminal in a Serb area, or the Croat police will go and arrest a Croat war criminal in a Croat area, or even the Bosniak police will arrest a Bosniak war criminal in a Bosniak area. We do not have the ability to leverage the local police to do that. They will not do it themselves. The only credible force who could do that are the international military, and they have chosen, under direction of the international politicians, not to do it.
Did you have a follow-up?
I just have a fairly quick question. I don't know. It wouldn't be a follow-up then.
Okay.
My question was on the time frame of these operations. I think when the UN goes into these things and they're taking police from all these different countries, the question is, how long are those police going to be involved, or how long are those countries going to be involved? I don't think people realize how long some of these things take. What sort of time frame should we look at in East Timor and Bosnia and so on, or expect when they're going?
Could you identify yourself as
well? Sorry, Douglas Brooks with the International Peace Operations.
You've got two different kinds of activity, even though they sometimes have the same physical manifestation on the ground. You have relief activities, you have development activities. Relief activities are, by definition, short-term, and the immediate relief for law and order can be just, you know, the provision of a presence in the first 100 days following an event or something like that. Development activities are, by definition, long-term. They are meant to be profoundly structural in their effect. You are sometimes talking even decades. And so you have got to understand what kind of program you're embarking on if you're a donor country. And it's quite legitimate to say, no, we will do relief, but we will not get involved in development, or we will only do development, we will not get involved in relief. The development programs for law and order are absolutely fundamental. You need training programs, you need assistance programs, you need all kinds of professionalization type programs, and that is definitely years and years. It's very little of that can be done in months. It's years or many years.
Okay, I think we'll leave the discussion at that, and I want to thank Graham for a very cogent presentation. Thank you.